All right, ready to jump into another deep dive. Today we're looking at a case that really highlights how even the tiniest details can have huge consequences in the legal world. It's Litwin v. Blackstone, and yeah, it's still making waves even though it dates back to the pre-financial crisis era.
What makes this case so interesting, I think, is that it kind of flips the script on the idea that only the big things matter when a company goes public.
Yeah, it's all about perspective, right?
Exactly. So you've got Blackstone, you know, the investment giant, going for this massive IPO back in 2007.
Right, when everyone thought the markets were going to climb forever.
Exactly. Investors are excited, money's flowing, and then the whole thing implodes. Turns out some investors were not too happy with what they saw, or rather what they felt was missing in all those IPO documents.
Oh, so we've got Blackstone going public, good times supposedly rolling, and then bam, the financial crisis. What exactly did they supposedly leave out of the paperwork?
Well, the investors, a group led by a guy named Litwin, they claimed Blackstone glossed over some pretty key details about some risks. Specifically, there were three main areas of concern.
Okay, laid it on me.
All right, so first, there were Blackstone's investments in FGIC. They were an insurance company and pretty heavily involved in those infamous subprime mortgages.
Ah, yeah, that's not good.
Right, so that's one. Then there were their investments in Freescale, a big player in the semiconductor world. And then, of course, you can't forget the looming real estate crash, which we all know ended up hitting Blackstone's portfolio pretty hard.
Okay, so the stage is set for a financial earthquake, and investors are saying Blackstone didn't give them the full picture. But here's what I find so interesting. Some of these investments, like that FGIC one, were just a teeny tiny sliver of Blackstone's total assets. We're talking like 0.4%. Like a rounding error, right?
Yeah, you'd think so. And Blackstone, that's basically what they argued. They were like, come on, these investments were so small, nobody would have changed their mind about investing based on that.
So, David versus Goliath. What happened?
Well, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, they didn't buy it. They said material, you know, what's important enough to disclose, it's not just about crunching numbers. It's about the story those numbers tell in the context of everything else.
I see. So it's like, yeah, maybe 0.4% on its own doesn't sound like much. But if that 0.4% is tied to something like, oh, I don't know, the entire subprime mortgage market, then suddenly it becomes a whole lot more significant.
Exactly. And this is where things get really interesting from a legal perspective.
Hit me with the legal stuff.
Okay. So this case, it's centered on some key laws, sections 11, 12A, 2, and 15 of the Securities Act of 1933, and these are all about protecting investors from being misled. The big question was whether Blackstone failed to disclose information that, you know, a reasonable investor would have wanted to know before deciding to buy their stock.
Now, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with disclosures and have to think about what's material all the time. So how did the court actually define materiality in this case? Was it really just about percentages, or was there something more to it?
That's the million-dollar question. The Second Circuit, they rejected this whole idea that there's some magic percentage you can use to determine materiality. They said you have to look at the entire context. It's not that simple.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. Think about it like this. Imagine you're buying a house, and there's this tiny little crack in the foundation.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah. On its own, maybe it's not a big deal, but what if that crack is actually a sign of a much bigger structural problem? Suddenly, that tiny detail becomes really important.
So how does that apply to Blackstone?
Well, in their case, even though some of these investments were tiny percentages of their overall holdings, the court said those investments could still be material because they were connected to these much bigger trends, like FGIC being linked to that whole subprime mortgage crisis, which was about to send shockwaves through, well, everything.
So it becomes less about the size of the investment and more about what that investment reveals about the company's overall strategy and maybe even their vulnerability.
Exactly. It's about connecting the dots.
So if I'm following you, it sounds like the court wasn't just fixated on the numbers themselves, but like how those numbers fit into the whole story Blackstone was trying to sell to investors, almost like they were cherry-picking data to paint a picture that wasn't totally accurate, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The court really zeroed in on how Blackstone framed these potential problems, or maybe it's more accurate to say how they tried to kind of downplay them.
So it wasn't enough for them to just like tuck these details away somewhere in that massive IPO prospectus they put out. They had to actively present the information in a way that wouldn't mislead investors.
Exactly. And the court found that Blackstone didn't quite hit the mark in several key areas.
Like what? Give me some specifics.
Okay, well, take FGIC as an example, that insurance company. Even though it was a tiny investment on its own, the court said it could still be material because Blackstone had been hyping up their insurance segment as like this huge growth area.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. By downplaying the potential risks associated with FGIC and all those subprime mortgages they were involved in, Blackstone basically created this misleading impression about the health of that whole segment.
It's like they were saying, hey, check out this shiny new insurance business. It's going to make us tons of money. kind of skipping over the fact that a big chunk of it was built on, you know, shaky ground.
That's a great way to put it. The court was like, you can't have it both ways, guys. You can't highlight something as a positive and then bury the potential downsides.
All right, so FGIC is one piece of the puzzle. What about the other investments Blackstone was accused of not disclosing properly? Like Freescale.
Ah, yes, Freescale. Well, that was a much bigger investment, something like 3.6% of their portfolio. But the court, they didn't just focus on the size. They pointed out that Freescale was a high-profile tech company, like a flagship investment for Blackstone.
I see. So if Freescale went belly up, it wouldn't just be about the money they lost, right?
Right. It could raise serious doubts about Blackstone's overall judgment, their ability to make smart investments.
Like if you're known for having the Midas touch, and suddenly one of your big splashy bets turns sour, people start to wonder if you've lost your magic.
Exactly. And that's the risk Blackstone didn't adequately disclose. They failed to acknowledge that a Freescale failure could really tarnish their reputation and make investors think twice.
Now, what about the big one, the real estate market? Everybody knew things were getting shaky back then, but did Blackstone really have to disclose specific properties that were in trouble? How could they have known exactly which ones were going to go under?
That's a good point, and it brings up a really important legal concept here. There's something called Item 303 of SEC Regulation SK. Basically, it requires companies to disclose any known trends or uncertainties that are reasonably likely to have a material impact on their business.
So even if Blackstone couldn't say for sure which specific buildings were about to go bust, they still had to disclose the general risk in the real estate market, because it was pretty obvious things were heading south.
Exactly. The court said you don't need perfect foresight to meet your disclosure obligations. It's about being upfront about the known risks, even if those risks are hard to nail down with, like, precise numbers.
So it's kind of like knowing there's a hurricane out at sea that's probably going to hit land. You might not know exactly where it's going to make landfall or how much damage it'll cause, but you got to warn people that a storm's coming.
Perfect analogy. That's basically what the Second Circuit told Blackstone. They were like, look, you can't just pretend the storm isn't there because you don't know exactly when and where it's going to hit.
Okay, so Blackstone got called out for trying to downplay these risks, even if they were tough to quantify. This whole idea of materiality, it seems pretty tricky. How did the Second Circuit's decision in Litwin v. Blackstone actually impact the way companies approach, like, IPOs and disclosures? Did it change the game at all?
Oh, absolutely. This case, it sent shockwaves through the corporate world. It made companies and their lawyers really rethink how they approach disclosures, especially when it comes to going public. They realized they couldn't just rely on those, like, arbitrary thresholds or percentages anymore.
It forced them to dig a little deeper.
Yeah, they had to consider the context, the bigger picture, and how their disclosures would be perceived by, you know, a regular investor.
So it's less about checking boxes and more about taking a step back and asking, what does an investor really need to know to make a smart decision?
Exactly. Litwin v. Blackstone really shifted things away from just looking at numbers toward a more holistic, context-driven approach.
See, this is what makes this whole case so fascinating to me. It really shows how the law has to adapt to keep up with how complex the financial world is. It's like the court is saying, we get that things are complicated, but you can't use that complexity as an excuse to mislead people.
You nailed it. Litwin v. Blackstone, it's a textbook example of how courts are increasingly realizing that investors need more than just numbers. They need context, they need insights, and they need companies to be upfront about the potential downsides, not just the shiny, happy stuff.
All right, so we've established that this case is a big deal, both for the legal world and in practice. But before we wrap up, I want to touch on one more thing about Litwin v. Blackstone that I found really interesting. The Second Circuit, they didn't just analyze the substance of what Blackstone disclosed. They also looked at how those disclosures were made, the actual language and presentation of those risks in the IPO documents.
Oh, you're right. That's crucial. The court was concerned not only with what Blackstone said, but also how they said it. Was the language clear and easy to understand? Did they try to bury important information or make risks seem smaller than they really were?
So it's not enough to just kind of, like, technically include the information somewhere in the document, right? You have to actually make sure it's presented in a way that a regular person would understand it. It's like the difference between shouting a warning from a rooftop and whispering it in a crowded room.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to dig into next. We'll explore how the court scrutinized the specific language Blackstone used and what lessons we can all take away from that.
So we've been digging into how Blackstone got called out for not properly disclosing certain risks in their IPO, even though those risks were just a tiny sliver of their overall holdings. But now I'm even more curious about the wording of those disclosures. Like, did they bury this info in a way that a normal investor wouldn't even notice?
That's exactly what the Second Circuit was looking into, the language and presentation of Blackstone's disclosures. They weren't just focused on whether the risks were technically mentioned somewhere, but also on whether Blackstone tried to downplay those risks or make them seem less important than they actually were.
So even if they technically checked the box of disclosing the risk, they could still get in trouble if they framed that information in a misleading way, or maybe buried it under a ton of legal jargon.
Exactly. It's like putting a warning label on a product, but printing it in a font so tiny that nobody can read it. The info might technically be there, but it's useless if it's presented in a way that's inaccessible or deceptive.
So what are some ways that companies try to obscure risks in their disclosures? Like, what kind of red flags should investors or anyone who reads these kinds of documents be looking out for?
Well, one common tactic is to bury crucial information deep within the document, surrounded by dense technical language. It's like hiding a needle in a haystack of legalese.
So even if an investor took the time to wade through all that dense language, they might not realize how important that one little sentence tucked away on page 50 actually is.
Exactly. Another common tactic is to use vague or ambiguous language. Instead of clearly stating the risk, they might just kind of hint at it, or use language that creates a sense of uncertainty rather than a clear warning.
Like, instead of saying, hey, there's a chance this investment could totally tank, they might say something like, the future performance of this investment is subject to a number of factors, some of which are beyond our control. Which, I mean, it's technically true, but it doesn't exactly scream danger Will Robinson.
You got it. And that's exactly what the court was looking for, signs that Blackstone was trying to soften the blow or downplay the seriousness of these potential risks.
So in Blackstone's case, what were some specific examples of how they might have tried to obscure those risks in their IPO documents?
Well, the court was particularly critical of how Blackstone handled the risks associated with FGIC, that insurance company heavily involved in the subprime mortgage market. Remember, Blackstone had been touting its insurance segment as this key growth area, but they didn't really properly disclose how FGIC's exposure to all those risky mortgages could potentially drag that whole segment down.
So even though they technically mentioned FGIC's involvement in subprime, they didn't really explain how that could backfire and hurt them.
Right. The court basically said that Blackstone had painted this rosy picture of FGIC's exposure to subprime mortgages, focusing on their past performance and downplaying the very real chance that the whole subprime market could implode. It's like bragging about how strong your house is while ignoring the fact that it's built right on top of a fault line.
Okay, so Blackstone got called out for not being straight up about the potential risks associated with FGIC. What about the other areas, like Freescale and the overall real estate market? Did the court find similar problems with how those risks were presented?
Yeah, the court found that Blackstone's disclosures about Freescale and the broader real estate market also lacked that necessary level of clarity and transparency. They weren't necessarily hiding the information, but they weren't exactly going out of their way to make it easy for investors to understand either.
So what's the big takeaway here? What can we learn from Litwin v. Blackstone about how to be smarter readers of these kinds of financial disclosures? It seems like there's a lot that companies can hide in plain sight, even if the information is technically there.
It's all about reading between the lines and being an active, critical reader. Don't just skim the surface, really dig in and ask yourself, what are they really saying here? What are they not saying?
So we need to watch out for vague language, be on the lookout for key info buried in obscure places, and consider whether the overall presentation feels designed to downplay potential problems.
Exactly. It's like being a detective, looking for clues, connecting the dots, and not taking everything at face value.
Litwin v. Blackstone is such a great example of how something seemingly small, like those tiny percentages we talked about, can actually tell a much bigger story about a company's transparency and whether they're being upfront with investors.
It reminds us that context is everything. It's not enough to just disclose the bare minimum. You have to present that information in a way that's clear, comprehensive, and doesn't mislead investors.
Well, I think we've uncovered some real gems in this deep dive into Litwin v. Blackstone. We've explored how complex this idea of materiality is, the importance of context in disclosures, and the dangers of hiding behind legal jargon. This case is a must-read for anyone involved in finance, whether you're a lawyer, an investor, or just someone who wants to understand how the game is played.
I couldn't agree more. This case really highlights how law, finance, and ethics all intersect. It reminds us that transparency and accountability are essential for a healthy market.
So as you're navigating the world of IPOs, financial statements, and investment decisions, remember what we've learned from Litwin v. Blackstone. Look beyond the numbers, scrutinize the language, and always ask yourself, what are they not telling me?
And with that thought-provoking question, we'll wrap up our deep dive for today. Stay informed, stay curious, and stay ahead of the game.